Hi, welcome to this week's program.
We all work hard to save for retirement. There are a few who start saving and investing early, plan things out with financial advisors, and essentially do everything right. But most of us get busy with life, settling ourselves into a career, raising a family, buying a home, sending our kids off to college, and then carrying on as empty nesters. All part of life's big changes and surprises, the joys, the hardships, and the heartaches. So it's not a big surprise that retirement planning often takes a back seat. There are also many amongst us who do not even start thinking about retirement until they're in their 50s, which really is quite late. But still, you should never throw your hands up and give up on retirement planning. And even though I say it's never too late to start, those who do start late have to deal with some unfortunate realities. Whatever the case, the fact is that retirement can be overwhelming. There's a lot to think about, a lot to plan, and a lot to do, which is why even people who think they are well prepared for retirement might find that there are things for which they simply forgot to plan or they didn't know that they needed to plan for. So as a heads up today, here are some of those unplanned things that might surprise you in retirement. Let's talk about the emotional side of retirement. You know, I've addressed this a few times on my show already. The fact that people often aren't emotionally prepared to retire because too much of their self-worth and self-esteem is tied into what they do for a living. Their careers, their job responsibilities, their job titles, the daily routine that gives meaning to their lives shapes their feelings about themselves. But once you stop working, how do you cope with the loss of so much of your sense of self? What do you do with all your free time? See, many of us cannot deal with the idea of retirement, and a lot of people go back to work because they're just not ready, mentally or emotionally, to get ready for retirement. They're not ready to retire. So prepare for this major life transition, perhaps by adding fulfilling activities to your life as you're ready for retirement, such as volunteering at your local library, maybe at your school or your church or any other organization where you can contribute something to society and keep a social life intact. All right, here's something you might not have thought of, enrolling for Medicare. You know, this is one where you must simply add this to your calendar. Put a reminder to self on your 65th birthday. Enroll in Medicare at 65, it should say. That's because you don't automatically qualify for Medicare unless you enroll. You'll pay a permanent financial penalty if you're late. So you pay a 10% penalty for every 12 months that you're late. So if you wait 24 months, that's a 20% penalty that's built in. So please do not neglect this. Medicare enrollment starts 3 months before age 65 and 3 months after your 65th birthday. So you have a nice wide 6-month window to do so. And really, there's no excuses for you not to enroll on time. Now, some people believe Medicare and Social Security are in the same bucket, but they're not. So while you can delay taking your Social Security, you still have to actively enroll in Medicare on your own. So continuing on these unplanned things that you might not be prepared for retirement, let's talk about healthcare costs. You know, here's one that might shock you. Healthcare costs, you know, and we know that prices are rising for healthcare. You hear it in the news all the time, and you see it when you look at your premiums. But did you know that studies project that healthcare cost will cost you about $250,000 for a couple in retirement? That's about $5,000 per year or $10,000 per couple, assuming an average retired life of 25 years. It's a lot of money. So make sure you're not underestimating healthcare costs in retirement. And, you know, you're talking about routine care, prescription drugs, procedures, and long-term care. So you want to plan for that substantial amount. And while we're talking about health, let's not forget about the fact that we're going to need dental work more and more as we age. So you have to add in dental expenses too. Medicare doesn't cover dental expenses. So factor in some surgeries and procedures and perhaps set aside somewhere between $10,000 and $30,000 for these expenses. Now, also, while retirees tend to do a good job of covering monthly bills, they often don't plan for those occasional large non-discretionary expenses, such as a leaky roof or new appliances or major car repairs. So it's important that you plan for these one-time expenses. Take a look at your budget on an annual basis and make sure you're taking into account these things that come up quarterly or semi-annually. And also, plan for a long life. You know, we were talking about planning for 25 years. That's because for a 55-year-old couple, there's a 50% chance that one of them will live into their 90s. So if you will live to 90, will your money last? And with that longevity come other needs, such as long-term care expenses, maybe living in a seniors facility or rejigging your home so you don't have to climb stairs and so on. So think about and talk to your advisor about living beyond 25 years in retirement. Also, you want to account for the financial needs of a surviving spouse, how he or she might be impacted by the loss of a dying spouse's pension and benefits, or an annuity they may have, or Social Security. Do a what-if analysis to see which income streams might stop, and also think beyond finances to issues such as long-term care and who will take care of the surviving spouse as they approach old age. And finally, your legal affairs. We're talking estate planning here. Make sure you put your legal affairs in order. In fact, on this, the reality is any of us could die or get severely incapacitated at any time of sickness or an accident, who knows what. So for all ages, it's important that you have an estate plan that clearly lays out how your assets will be distributed and who will act as your fiduciary, who might have control over your healthcare decisions and other critical essential needs. Having a will and a living trust can save your survivors a lot of time, headache, and cost, because without these documents, all those decisions will be handled by the state. And really, do you want to leave those important matters in the hands of the state and the court? So make sure all of your beneficiaries are correctly listed and up to date, and also make sure you have a financial power of attorney and a healthcare directive. So I recommend having a family meeting and let them know your wishes and your desires. So if you plan for all of the above, there should be few financial surprises in retirement. Then hopefully all the surprises you do get in your golden years will be the ones that bring a smile to your face. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Donna Rosato is a senior writer at Money, where she writes about financial challenges facing retirees and strategies for career advancement. This is part two, where Donna and myself discuss Money Magazine's responses to readers' questions. Hey, Donna, welcome back for part two.
I am really glad to be talking with you again, Steve.
So let's get started. Question number one. I'm in my 50s. I got laid off a few months ago. What's the secret to landing a new job when you've been out of work a long time?
Well, that's a real issue for folks who are older. There's this new report from the AARP Public Policy Institute that was based on interviewing folks who were older and landed new jobs. And we found some surprising strategies that older workers are using to get back into the workforce.
Yeah, that's great. So let's hear some of them.
So one of the things we found is that, you know, it's a good thing for you to try out a new occupation. You know, almost two-thirds of the re-employed older workers found jobs in an entirely new occupation. And that was true for women even more so than men. Of course, the traditional advice is that, hey, you kind of should stick with what you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we found that for folks that the change was really a time to do something that was more personally rewarding and interesting. And I think a lot of people, when they're looking at it sort of in your 50s, looking for that sort of second career, are looking for something less stressful,
mm-hmm.
and maybe fewer hours. So I think that's where some of the change comes
from. Yeah, but I think the point that you're making as well is to embrace change and not to resist it, right?
That's right. That's right. Don't be afraid. You know, don't be afraid to try a new venture. That was a strategy that worked for a lot of folks.
All right, so what was another strategy that people were using, those that were able to successfully get reemployed?
Well, you have to be aggressive. And I think this is probably true of all workers, but especially, you know, older re-employed workers, almost half of them, when they landed a new job, had contacted employers directly about the job. And that was because, you know, like you reapply for a job online, you don't know what happens to things. And
yeah, it's the black hole, right? You really want to get out there and beat the bushes and, you know, get the scuffs on your shoes, so to speak, and really start talking to everybody and contacting the jobs or the bosses directly. What about networking? You know, everybody tells you got to go out and network, but, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. What's the thinking on that?
Well, it was very interesting. Half of the people who landed a new job reach out to their network for leads, but only a third of them use personal contacts, like friends and family. But here's where I think an older worker has an advantage. You want to reach out directly to people who are in the field of where you want to be. And I think older workers have those more valuable contacts. You know, it may be a waste of time to be talking to your neighbor or your friend about what you want to do when you've got very good contacts. You've been working for a long time. Use those folks. Use professional contacts to find out about opportunities. Rely less on friends and family.
What about the use of social media? There's a lot of hype about LinkedIn. You must be on LinkedIn. And Facebook, were they very effective in getting new jobs?
This was a really interesting part of the report of the study, that about half of the people who got reemployed definitely found online job boards a good source of job leads. And that's because the job boards are really specific to the industry, not just general. But only 13% said online social media networks like LinkedIn and Facebook were effective in helping them get a job.
Yeah, so that was 13%, not a very high number.
No, and that's surprising. Everyone says, use LinkedIn. But I think one of the reasons maybe is people may not know how to use LinkedIn. You have to constantly update your online resume. You need to really directly reach out to people. People aren't just going to find you on LinkedIn. You have to really know how to use it.
Good point. So here's another question. I want to find part-time work to bring in extra income when I retire next year, but I don't want to be a greeter at Walmart. How do I find a job that's meaningful but still flexible enough for me to enjoy my retirement life?
Well, it's a really interesting question because I think you know that most people say they don't want to stop working completely when they retire. Some people want to work beyond retirement age, but a lot of people say their ideal retirement is working, but they want to do a job that is fulfilling, but also flexible. So that is a little harder to find. You know, if you want something that's flexible, it may not be the thing that might be the most valued by an employer. Most employers want you to have your nose to the grindstone.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
So, yeah, and I think, you know, some people just want to bring in some income. Some people want to just do something different. But most people don't want to go from a professional career to something that's sort of mindless and boring.
What about the idea of, with your current employer, downshifting to part-time? Is that realistic?
You know, I've done a couple of pieces on, there's a traditional name for it called phased retirement, where you stay with your employer and you sort of ease into it, cutting back your hours, maybe giving up some duties like, you know, managing people, and just kind of focusing on the core of what you do. And very few employers have formal programs, I think about 10%. But when I've interviewed people, I found lots of people who were able to kind of do this on an informal basis with their employer. Now, when you downshift, you know, you give up money. You know, you're not going to be able to work fewer hours and get the same pay. So you really have to run the numbers and see if that makes sense. But it does. I mean, you're a known quantity to your employer. You can still add value. And look, it can be a win-win for them if they have to pay you less.
You know, one of the answers to this question surprised me, and I'll just read part of it. Fill in at a high level for mid and higher level executives. Another option is to temp as an interim executive. So I didn't even realize that that was kind of an available profession and that there would be executive headhunters out there looking, you know, to fill those kinds of temporary positions for executives.
It really is out there. And it makes a lot of sense, right? Companies may be in between and hiring. They may only want someone while they're transitioning to something new or for specific projects, specific expertise. And it's a great opportunity if you really like that sort of prestige and the pace of executive life, but you want to do things project by project. So you sign up for 6 months, 3 months, mm-hmm. maybe a year,
yeah.
and you've got that, but there's an end date to it. And I think you should look. There are places, for example, there's a group called the Riley, R-I-L-E-Y Guide, that lists firms that are specializing in placing interim executives. But I also encourage people to look at retiredbrains.com,
mm-hmm.
which does focus on workers with a lot of experience and not always executive level, but very professional workers looking for project-based type work.
That's great information. And to hear this again, don't forget to join the conversation at onthemoneyradio.org, where we will post the segment with Donna Rosato. Donna Rosato is with Money Magazine and writes about the financial challenges facing retirees and strategies for career advancement. We're running out of time here, but one that I did notice that I liked was to seek adventure. Check out coolworks.com's Older and Bolder section. It's aimed at retirees looking for seasonal or temporary jobs at national parks, lodges, ranches, and other outdoor destinations. Real quick, tell us about that.
I talked to a number of people who are doing that. If you really want to do something different and fun, you know, this is a really, really interesting, just really out of the box thing for you to do. I know a lot of couples do that together and they get to do some traveling.
Mm.
And you get to use your brain because
yeah.
usually you are giving information about
yeah.
the park or the history of
yeah.
the place.
So I think the bottom line is don't give up. Think bigger. Expand your world. Embrace change. And have some fun in this next part of your life. You may find it very rewarding. As I said before, my guest, Donna Rosato, senior writer at Money. She writes about financial challenges facing retirees, strategies for career advancement. And to find out more about Donna, and to hear this interview again, join the conversation at onthemoneyradio.org. Once again, hey, Donna, that was a lot of fun. Thanks so much. We'll have you back.
Oh, thanks so much, Steve.
Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com.
Listening to the Steve Pomeranz Show.
My guest is Sarah Cooper. She is a writer, a comedian, and creator of a satirical blog, thecooperreview.com, which attracts over 100,000 readers per month. And as a break from all the serious stuff we discuss here, I thought Sarah's take on office life and things in general could be a lot of fun. Hey, Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, you're writing now, you've got your first book, you're a comedian, and yet before all of this, you worked for Google, which was, you know, a pretty special job. How did you decide to walk away from a job like that to become a writer?
Yeah, it was pretty hard. Everybody thought I was crazy because, you know, it's one of the best places to work in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not happy there, then pretty much you have no chance of ever being happy is kind of what everyone thought.
Mm-hmm.
including my parents and my husband and my therapist, everybody. But I figured it was more of a risk to not try. You know, I was a few years away from turning 40, which is kind of a big age milestone. And, you know, sometimes you just feel like you got to just give it a shot. And so I figured, you know, if it didn't work out, I could always maybe go back to Google. But if I didn't try, I'd never know. So that's kind of how I decided.
Is 40 an age milestone at Google too?
It is, especially in the tech world where everyone is just out of college and everybody seems to be 22 years old. I think reaching 40 is like a bit scary.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that might have had been some of the reason that you decided to go a different direction as well?
Yeah, I think that I read some quote that said, if there's something that you want to do and you don't do it by 40, there's a good chance you'll never do it. And that scared the hell out of me. So I figured if I wanted to write a book, I better, you know, get on that.
Well, that's great. So I'm looking at your blog. One of the things that I really laughed over was 10 tricks to appear smart in meetings. So everyone in this world, you know, goes to meetings, whether you work for a nonprofit or you work for a business or a corporation or whatever it is. And, you know, so you put together 10 tricks to appear smart in meetings. So tell us about those.
Yeah. So I was in a lot of meetings and I would notice these little things that people would do to appear as if they knew what they were talking about when really they hadn't been paying attention at all.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one is draw a Venn diagram. I remember when someone got up and just drew this ridiculous Venn diagram, I thought everyone was going to make fun of him. But instead, everyone started helping him draw it and telling him how big the circle should be and what the label should be. And then he just sat back down and went back to looking at Facebook or whatever he was doing. And I thought, wow, that just made him look really, really smart. And so that was the first one that I noticed.
Yeah.
Another one, which I haven't been able to try yet, but I think is brilliant, is translate percentages into fractions. So if someone says 25% of people clicked on this button, say, oh, about 1 in 4,
right,
and then make a note of it.
Right.
And it just makes you look like you have really sharp math skills, even though you haven't added anything to the conversation whatsoever.
Exactly. Right.
It's a great one.
Yeah. And I like this one here. So encourage everybody to take a step back. Let's just take a step back here and review what we've just talked about. Tell me about that.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of times people are chiming in with their ideas, and obviously you're not paying attention, so you don't have any ideas. So you could just stop everyone and say, guys, let's take a step back here. Mm-hmm. And then when you have everyone's attention, ask a vague question like, what problem are we really trying to solve?
Oh, yeah.
And people will be like, oh, wow, that's so deep. You know, you really took control of this meeting and you helped us get back on track, even though you haven't actually contributed anything.
We're talking about 10 tricks to appear smart in meetings. The fourth trick is to nod continuously while pretending to take notes.
Yes. And I saw somebody do this and, you know, he was in a meeting and he just seemed to be writing down every other word that people were saying. And I know that when he looked at those notes a few hours later, they didn't make any sense to him whatsoever. But if you looked at him during the meeting, he was nodding and he was writing. And so it looked like he was really engaged, even though I think his mind was definitely somewhere else.
I bet you there's also something if you have like a pad and paper versus an iPad or a laptop, the pad and paper seems much more serious.
It does. It makes it seem like you are really, you know, taking in the information a lot more than if you're on your phone or you're on your laptop, it looks like you might be on Instagram or something. Mm.
Well, another favorite one of mine, and if you're in business these days, especially I guess if you're in the technology business, one big question that's always asked is, will this scale?
Yes.
And no matter what it is, ask the question, will this scale? So what does that actually mean? Does anybody know?
Nobody knows. Nobody knows what that means. But it's a great question that will make everybody stop and think, and it drives people who know what that means nuts. So, and that's good too. So it's definitely a good question to ask. Just ask if it's going to scale.
Yeah, the idea basically is if you have an idea, can you repeat it in an infinite way? Because that's really how these big technology companies make their billions. Facebook is completely scalable.
Right.
From one user to, you know, 100 million users. There's no more incremental technology you really, really need or infrastructure. So it's scalable.
You sound so smart right now.
Oh,
I'm really impressed.
I'm really impressed. Well, I don't know. Let's just take a moment to step back.
Yeah, good idea.
Pace around the room is also another technique that you recommend if you want to appear smart in meetings. Why is that?
Well, I was in a meeting once and a VP just got up and started walking back and forth. And I didn't know what he was thinking. I thought, you know, is he pissed off? Is he going to cancel this project? Is he going to walk out? I had no idea, but I knew that my respect for him went through the roof. And so pacing around the room just makes it look like you're really, you know, contemplating everything. You can walk over to the window, take a sigh, you know, nod, you know, cross your arms. You know, it kind of makes people wonder what you're thinking, which always makes you look smart.
I suppose if you would then take a moment to step out for a very important phone call, that might even add more to the respect that you would get.
Definitely, because people are very aware of the fact that this meeting is important. But if you have a phone call that's even more important than the important meeting that you're in, that means you're really important. So go ahead, say that you have to take this and step out for a little bit.
Number 8 is ask the presenter to go back a slide. Would you go back a slide, please? I want to kind of, you know, revisit that statement that you just made. Well, how does that separate you from the meeting?
Well, your coworkers will immediately think that there's something on that slide that they missed that you're going to brilliantly point out. And you don't actually have to point anything out. You can just say, what do these numbers mean? Or you could just look at it and go, okay, yeah, we can move on now. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what you say. It just makes people think that there's something that you're going to say that's really interesting, even though you haven't been paying attention at all. The only caveat with this one is don't say, can you go back a slide if the presenter's on the first slide, because that will make people realize you aren't paying attention.
You're just an idiot, basically.
Yeah.
And that's really what you're trying to avoid at all costs, is this idea that you're really not paying attention. You really don't care what's going on in the meeting. You are kind of like an idiot in this situation, and yet you're really trying to appear as if you are, you know, an alpha person. You're on top of your game.
Exactly.
Okay. And then finally, make fun of yourself. Why is making fun of yourself a good tactic?
Well, I mean, it just shows that you're really comfortable with, you know, not taking yourself too seriously. You know, I was super impressed when somebody gets asked a question and the response is, you know what, I haven't heard anything anyone said for the past hour. Everyone laughs and they're like, oh my goodness, he's so honest. You know, he's being, you know, so jovial. It's so funny. And so that's something that you can always just do to make yourself seem smart, is just not take yourself too seriously.
My guest is Sarah Cooper, a writer, comedian, and creator of the satirical blog, thecooperreview.com. I really recommend you go and check it out. It's pretty funny. A couple of videos on how to nod correctly. And, you know, there's different kinds of nodding, right? Showing that you're listening in a certain way. And then tell us about how to nod properly.
Well, it's really important that you're nodding in the right way during a meeting, because, you know, you could nod the same way you've nodded before, but then people are going to notice that you're just sort of, you know, robotically nodding. So a lot of good nods are like the slow, I'm really taking that in nod. Or you could do the, oh, that's a good point, I'm going to write that down nod. And then you can just pretend to write it down. Then, of course, there's the nodding off nod where you're sort of falling asleep, which is a lot of people. So there's just a bunch of different nods that you can do.
Yeah, I guess if you do the same one, then everybody goes, oh, that's the Sarah nod. She's not really listening.
Exactly.
She's just placating me. So forget it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So try to mix up your nodding game when you're in meetings.
You also have 9 tricks to make you look like you're the creative force on your team. I like these very much. The first one is leave to get water and ask if anyone needs anything.
Yes, this one's brilliant, actually, because first of all, it gets you out of the first 10 minutes of the meeting. You can just kind of not be there, which is always a bonus. But then when you know, even if no one says that they want anything, just bring back stuff, bring back some water, bring back some snacks, and people will just automatically start eating and drinking the snacks. And then it'll look like you really can predict the future because you were able to predict that they wanted snacks.
Yeah. You anticipated their needs.
Mm-hmm.
And you also gave them something. So you're now, you know, kind of more special than everybody else.
Yes.
Grab a pad of sticky notes and start drawing.
Yes. This is a great one because even before you even know what the problem is or what the question is, people will think, wow, he already is coming up with all of these great ideas. And you can just draw like meaningless flow charts or, you know, kind of standard graphs or anything you want to draw. And it'll just look like you're coming up with something.
But the thing is, if you're using sticky notes, that means that you're giving the impression that those notes are going to end up on a board or on the wall somewhere.
Exactly. So, even if they just end up in the trash.
Make an analogy that's so simple, it sounds deep. And you have one here. By the way, this comes with drawings as well. We have the cake, but the cake needs sprinkles. What are the sprinkles? Good example of a question you ask that sounds so deep, but actually, no, not so much.
Yeah, exactly. But the funny thing is that people are so polite in these meetings that no one's going to be like, that's ridiculous. They're going to go, oh, the sprinkles. Yeah, that's true. We do need sprinkles. Yeah. So you'll automatically make people think that you're pretty deep.
We only have time for one more. Ask if we're asking the right question. You know, shouldn't we be asking if this ask is the right ask? Is this the question we should be asking?
Yes. And using ask as a noun like that always makes you look like you're in tune with a meeting. But always question the questions. And if someone says, well, what are the right questions? Just say, you just asked one. And then that'll get you out of having to say anything else for the rest of the meeting.
Some other phrases. But how is this disruptive? Or is this 10X? Is this the future? Or I thought that was dead. And the final one is, but isn't Apple doing that? So that shuts down all conversations, right? Because if Apple's doing it, you know, there's no point in going after that. They're too big.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
My guest, Sarah Cooper, a writer, comedian, creator of the satirical blog, thecooperreview.com. Go check it out. It's pretty funny. She's also got a book. What's your book?
My book is 100 Tricks to Appear Smart in Meetings, which we just went through a few of them, and it's on sale now on Amazon. So you can go get it for yourself or one of your coworkers or your boss, maybe.
And you can hear this conversation, read all about it if you go to the website, stevepomerantz.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Sarah.
Thank you.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one. And a blue one and a yellow one. And they're all made out of ticky-tacky. And they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran,
Ooh,
with Keller Williams in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
This next one really bugs me here. How do you tell if a criminal has stolen your home?
Yeah. You know, with the rise of technology, it makes it a lot easier to create fraudulent documents that could easily be recorded in the public records. So you need to know that, A, that could happen, and B, be aware of signs that it's actually happened to you.
We're going
to
get into that in a second, but you have a story with your mom, right?
Yeah, my mom was holding a mortgage on a home and somebody got a hold of her signature and recorded a satisfactory of mortgage.
So she had lent money to someone, so she was holding that mortgage.
Correct.
And then someone came in, fraudulently signed a document that said the mortgage was paid and satisfied.
That's right.
Ooh, that's bad.
Ooh, yeah. Not good.
Yeah, so you got to be very careful. But there are some signs that you can look for, kind of easy signs to see whether something nefarious is happening.
Yeah, that's right. You know, for example, you're getting mail addressed to you in a different name, or you stop getting mail that you normally would get. Those would be signs. And you know, one of the biggest signs, anytime you move, all of a sudden you get an onslaught of unsolicited mail from movers and, you know,
insurance
and, you know, services, blinds.
Furniture.
So all of a sudden, if you're getting an onslaught of unsolicited mail in a big way,
right,
you need to check out your
I think it's the only good thing that we can say about direct mail is that if you start
it's a warning
it's
sign.
It's a warning sign if you start getting it.
Yeah.
Thank heavens for direct mail.
Yeah. So you just have to go to the property appraiser local website.
Yeah. So you go to your county's website.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to find your deed and you'll be able to find everything.
Any recorded instrument is online.
Yeah.
You can
online,
find it there.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's county by county.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, by doing that, checking once in a while, looking for these signs, you can probably stop this criminal behavior.
Yes.
Hopefully.
Put those criminals behind bars.
So I want to talk about some of the things that go on in your world that lay people like myself don't really think about or understand.
Sure.
So here's a question. Does deposit acceptance, I guess if a seller agrees to take a deposit, Does that turn an offer into a contract?
No.
Oh, okay. Next question.
Next. Deposits often provide evidence of a buyer's commitment to purchasing a house, but it is not required by law. So to have a binding contract to purchase real estate, it only requires consideration, which is defined as something of value offered by something else of value.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you have a buyer and a seller and they agree, you have what's called the meeting of the minds. In the case of real estate purchase, buyer's consideration is money, right? So the purchase price is that money, and the seller's consideration is the deed to the property.
Okay, sure.
So in essence, you don't actually, I mean, we always have deposits. Yeah. We want deposits. We want large deposits.
Yeah.
The reason why you want deposit money was in the event the buyer decides to not go through with the transaction, then the seller has recourse in collecting that money.
You know, I've seen a case of a client of mine who went to sell a pretty expensive house, and so he was having trouble selling it. And then someone came in and let's say it was $1 million or $1.5 million house. And the guy was putting down $3,000. And I said to the client, you know, that does not seem like a good faith deposit to me. And it turned out that it was nothing. I don't know what the buyer was doing or whatever.
Right.
But I mean, if someone's putting down a very small deposit on a very expensive house, that is really not good faith. And I think the seller should beware.
Right. And basically, the buyer is saying, well, geez, you know, I can walk from this for $3,000.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really
exactly
what it boils down to.
That's
so you want it to be painful.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's why we ask for
well, you know, corporations do that all the time when they're doing a merger.
Right.
If the merger doesn't work out, they have to pay like sometimes tens of millions. If it's a big company, $100 million to get if the thing fails.
Right.
So it's painful. Once the other company, what the companies are committing to each other, all those resources and time, publicity and all that, there's pain to get out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right, here's one. Can a condo owner enclose their porch, so-called, let's call it a lanai,
right,
without permission of the condo board? Because there's a story here of someone who actually did that. And, you know, it's this idea of taking, let's say, a decent-sized porch and enclosing it with glass, adding air conditioning to it. So you kind of have a new family room and expands your space. Pretty cool idea.
Right, right.
But again, if you're living in a controlled apartment area, then it affects other people.
Right. Well, you have to adhere to what is written in the documents. And to answer the question, I would say probably not, not without their permission. You've got an association. Everything wants to be uniform and look the same. Lanais are considered limited common elements. So in other words, it is part of the association's property. You need to adhere to the rules of what they say. There's all kinds of reasons. You know, you just can't randomly enclose it. There's the material that you're using that has to be approved.
Yeah.
You know, if everyone started doing, can you imagine if you had a building and somebody puts black glass, somebody puts white glass,
yeah,
somebody puts purple glass.
That's the point.
You know, it would not be uniform for
right,
starters. And so, no, you could actually be fined by the association as well. So whatever you do when it comes to making any changes to your lanai, absolutely
get permission,
the approval,
yeah,
from the association.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on. We only have a minute left. So there's a thing called a kick-out clause, right of first refusal. I know what that is.
Right.
I don't really know what a kick-out clause is. Are they the same?
No, they're not the same. A kick-out clause is used, Steve, when, for example, you're buying a house and you have it contingent on the sale of your home.
Yeah.
And the seller will say, okay, I'll give you a kick-out clause, meaning if I get another buyer, you have the rights to remove that contingency and I'll continue with you. I have the rights to accept this backup offer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kick-out clause,
okay,
which is different,
yeah,
than first right of refusal.
Yeah, first right of refusal means that I can say no or yes. I'm going to take the house, you know, or I'm not. But you have to come to me first in order.
Right, right, right. And you see that with leases. A tenant's leasing the property and they want the first right of refusal,
yeah,
to purchase the house before you consider a third.
That
that's more appropriate for,
yeah, got it,
for that.
Okay. My guest, as always, is Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams located in Boca, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, PomerantZ.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Bob Colhan is an actor and former faculty member in Chicago's famed Second City. His company, Business Improv, creates corporate training programs which use the direct connections between improvisation and business. Bob has worked with the likes of Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, and his techniques are something that we can all use, whether it's for business or just to interact more productively with the people around us. Bob Colhan, welcome to the show. So happy to have you.
Steve, thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So you're steeped in the background of improv and worked with so many people in that industry and learned a lot of the techniques. How did it occur to you that these techniques could be valuable in the business world?
Well, I have an undergrad in business, and I was quite successful in business before my mid-20s, 24, 25, and I left business to get into improvisation and do the best I can never to enter business again, only to find out that in the mid-90s, a professional improviser was a contradiction in terms. And I started doing a lot of corporate training for a lot of other great houses in Chicago. And it was at that time in the late 90s, very vacuous, empty. People were taking the programs and saying it was fun. I just can't use any of this stuff. And now I have to actually go back to work and make up for the 3, 4, or 5 hours I spent here. So it was kind of a fun waste of time. And I knew that there was more substance between two things that I really loved, business and, of course, improvisation. And I had a very serendipitous turn of events take place in which the Duke Fuqua School of Business was looking for some experiential learning. And I was in the right place at the right time to start collaborating on some experiential learning. And then we're off and running. So I could create depth and substance to the experiential learning that improvisation inherently provides through, of course, great business schools and great businesses, and also through behavioral psychology and cognitive psychology and organizational theory and behavioral decision making.
Well, your parents must have loved to hear that conversation with them when you said, you know, I'm not going into business. We've just spent thousands and thousands of dollars for me to get my degree. I'm going to improv. So what was that conversation like?
Challenging. So especially because by 24 years old, I'd already won a couple of Bank of America awards for small business creative marketing in Chicago Regional.
You were on your way, man.
I was on my way. And I told them that I'm leaving to go study improv with all my heart and passion and energy. And they were firmly against it. And what I asked for was about a 4-year grace period. It took me 4.5 years to get through college. And I wanted just about the same amount to see what I could do with improvisation. And then pretty much by coincidence, at the end of that 4, 4.5 years, that's when I started marrying improvisation to business and moving forward. So I negotiated with them.
Yeah. So what was it like to work at Second City? What years did that take place?
I started teaching for the Second City around 99, I believe. It might have even been 98. So just for the sake of trying to be generously accurate, I'll say 99, and really continued to work with them in one capacity or another through 2013 or so, as I was auditing audition sessions they would put together in New York for people with talent to go on their cruise ships. And I toured with them on their cruise ships. In fact, that's where I met my wife. She was a dancer on one of the cruise ships, and I was a Second City improv and sketch comedian. And I taught for them for the better part of a decade and was, of course, their first core faculty, me and two other people. And you're talking about one of the greatest American institutions. Yeah. And really, when it comes to the art of improvisation, it's the greatest institution in the entire world, at least in my eyes. And there's several others that can compete with it. They're just the mothership of it. You can kind of say they were the first in doing this with sketch comedy and satire starting in 1959. And there's no other place like it. And for that record, like Chicago, when it links to improvisation in the entire world.
So you mentioned the word art, but you know, art requires discipline. It's often rules-based. I'm a musician. I understand that. I think even a visual artist understands that there's rules, a perspective and other. What are some of the rules of improvisation that translate into business to make people more successful?
The cornerstone of all improvisation is a two-word phrase called yes and. Yes is unconditional acceptance. You give me this gift, this offer, this opportunity, and then is the bridge to what you do with it, your intelligence, your energy, your attitude. And this is the fundamental rule of improvisation because it leads to so many different things like postponing judgment, which is also important in business, slowing down, being focused and present in the moment. Very important to business, especially as it relates to leadership and presence and mindfulness and emotional intelligence. The ability to create on an individual basis and create inside of an ensemble or team. So you're talking about collaboration, communication. Improvisation is a communication-based art form inherently. So it leads directly to communication. And as you link yes and to communication, it's also a conflict management technique. So really, the rules of improvisation as an art applied directly to business in so many ways.
So this idea, I'm trying to visualize this on stage. So if a fellow improv member will throw you an idea and you're basically have to be in the moment and you're saying yes, you may not actually say it, but you're thinking, okay, yes. And now you have to take that idea and you have to move it along in your own unique way. And so is that the process you're describing?
Absolutely. You don't always have to say yes and to mean yes and. Mm-hmm. And yes and does not always mean yes, I agree with you 100% and I'm always going to do what you say.
Okay.
It's a way for us to come together to find common ground and build off of each other and be inspired by each other. Mm-hmm. And that takes an incredible amount of focus and concentration and listening to be present in the moment, observation skills, to really link up with one or more other individuals to collaborate in real time and organically discover the next things that you're going to do and say in the context of a show.
All right. You know, thinking about improvisation, I'm a musician and I understand the art of jazz improvisation. And, you know, many people think that it's all created on the spot and every note or every phrase is original, but there's a mental catalog that a jazz player will have of ideas that they've played or other people's ideas that they may input into their solo. And there's only really, I don't know what the percentage would be, but you know, there's only a smaller percentage that's actually created at that moment. When you're handed something as an improviser or in business, an idea, how much of that is trained knowledge that you've already had and that you're going to be vamping on, and how much of it is true improvisation?
All great improvisation is based in training and knowledge and repetition, practice, 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 regardless of which direction you're going to take it. Now, we don't have the confines necessarily that music or jazz puts into place with so many measures or bars or only X number of notes. Mm-hmm. We have a much more limitless possibility. Mm-hmm. And that allows us to organically explore and heighten and discover really to infinite potentials. That said, if you do not have a strong foundation, a clear understanding of what's going on, a common language we can use, a shared set of beliefs, a common goal, and years, hours and hours and hours, endless hours of practice, you are not going to be able to improvise and perform at the top of your intelligence in any art at the same level that somebody else can who is putting in that time, energy, effort.
When you go into a workshop in a corporation, you've got X hours to work with these people. Maybe it's a full week. I really don't know how it works. And so how do you get them to be able to come up with something and to change their behaviors in such a short period of time? What are some of your techniques?
Sure. So our programs in business improv range anywhere from 30, 60, 90 minute keynote type of presentation to multiple days. So they're all custom created. So in an average program, which lasts around 4 hours, the first thing that we all really have to do is create a common understanding of why we're there. And that includes looking at improvisation as a medium for delivering these types of messages and the challenges they face inside their organization. Because a creativity program for one organization is not going to be a great fit for a creativity program in another organization. And my four examples will be a creative organization like Pepsi Cola Creative or a pharmaceutical company. Mm-hmm. They're not going to deal with it the same. So it's really understanding where they are, what they want to do, their goals, and then showing the delivery on how to get there. And then ultimately, we ask them to postpone judgment. Postpone judgment of the exercises, of each other, of themselves, of exactly what we're going to do until the tail end of the program, when we can put our critical thinking hats back on and say, this is what's happening at this point. My 3.5-year-old son just
watched. Yeah, I heard. That's fine.
Hey,
so
Casey.
We're going to be improvising from this moment forward.
Yeah. Yes, I'm in an interview right now, buddy. It's a new friend of mine, Steve. Here, follow Samantha, okay? All right, I love you, buddy. I'll talk to you in a bit.
Bob Culhan is father and also an actor and former faculty member in Chicago's famed Second City. His company, Business Improv, creates corporate training programs to help people in business use the skills of improvisation to communicate better. So I think most people, when they're in a situation with somebody and they're listening to somebody, they're not actually listening. They're thinking about what they're going to say in response. And this idea that I read on your site about, you know, being in the moment, it's kind of difficult and it's something that we're not naturally inclined to do. What exercises would you say you'd give me to make sure that I'm kind of staying in the moment and not thinking about myself?
You are articulating one of the basic human communication pitfalls in that we think about what we're going to say next, as opposed to being focused and present in the moment and simply reacting to what somebody is saying to us. So if we go back to yes and as really our scarlet thread throughout improvisation and focus on it as a communication tool, the two words yes and will actually slow the brain down so that you are focusing and present in the moment. Because yes is yes implied, I hear you. You have my undivided attention. I'm listening to you right now and not focused on any other 3.5-year-old distractions that may come in. And then is the bridge to show how I'm focused, how I'm present, how I'm simply reacting to you. So really by using that two-word phrase, yes, and, you are slowing the brain down to be present, to simply respond. And it can keep you from falling into that human communication pitfall of thinking about what to say next.
So many people I talk to, and I'm sure you've talked to, will say that their greatest fear is public speaking. They have tremendous stage fright. And even though I talk to the public a lot, I mean, I still get, you know, a little perspiry when it's my turn or whatever. It doesn't necessarily come natural to me. How do you deal or help these people who are now have to kind of are in small groups? You're there trying to help them learn how to communicate. How do you get them beyond their stage fright?
Well, there's multiple ways to hit a pinata, right? There's more than one way to hit a pinata. So what's important to understand in the workshops is that these can manifest themselves in so many different ways, including what I call ride the bike type of programs. If you're teaching somebody how to ride a bike, you don't present it, you don't watch a video or read a case study about it. Everybody's up on the bike at the same time riding it.
Right.
So that's number one, that there's safety in numbers. We're not highlighting people and making examples of them, good or bad. Now, if you're looking at a presentation program that we've run many times that use components of improvisation to strengthen reacting to the unexpected inside of a presentation, technology malfunctions, unexpected questions, asking the right questions back to the audience, that's a different scenario altogether. And one of the things that I direct people toward is the idea of engaging. And this goes back to something my mentor used to say to me. And my mentor created the Second City Training Center. Mm-hmm. And he used to say, to be interested is to be interesting. And we've repurposed that in business improv. To be engaged is to be engaging. Mm. So as a presenter, instead of focusing on being nervous or what you're going to do, which is all internal thoughts, you're pushing your head internal to, oh, I'm so nervous, I got to get out of my head and think about this.
Yeah.
Push it external. Push it out to your audience and focus on engaging single individuals. And just say, my job is to engage you. And in doing so, you're going to be more engaging to them. And a result is at least an increase in probability in your content being more impactful.
Yeah, get out of your brain. You know, some people say that you imagine the audience naked, but I find that totally distracting. That doesn't help me one bit.
I don't want to see half the audience.
I really don't want to see that, you know. Finally, you know, using these techniques can strengthen your personal brand. This is something you speak about as well. And you want to get kind of prepared for any kind of meeting, I guess, no matter how small or no matter how large. You made the analogy that before you go outside, you check to see what the weather is, and you take a moment to pull yourself together, dress appropriately, bring an umbrella. And it's kind of the same technique you want to use, because what you present as your personal brand really matters. Take us through that just a little bit. We have under a minute.
Absolutely. First thing to understand is energy and attitude are choices. It's a choice to be low energy. It's a choice to have a bad attitude. It's a choice to be high energy. And it's a choice to have a good attitude. So taking that same time that you would normally designate toward checking the weather, 1 or 2 minutes, and dressing appropriately, and putting that time in before a meeting, an engagement, a phone call to say, where's my energy? Where's my attitude? Am I physically and mentally the place I need to be to execute at a very high level, to be elite at my job, can pay itself off tremendously.
Yeah. So get energetic, you know, stand up straight, you know, just get into that game
smile.
Mode, right? A smile, that helps a lot.
Oh, yeah.
My guest, Bob Culhan. The company is called businessimprov.com or Business Improv, and you can find him at businessimprov.com. Thanks a lot, Bob. Appreciate it. That was fun.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it as well.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.